by. Welcome, everyone. Thank you very much for holding and for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, Maximizing IBM DB2 V8 Using the DB2 Utilities. Today's teleconference will last approximately 60 minutes and will include a live question and answer session. In this teleconference, you'll learn about DB2 V8 features, including best practices for performance, availability, and usability. The speaker for today's teleconference is Brian Smith, IBM Distinguished Engineer, DB2 for ZOS Utilities Development. At this time, I'd like to hand it over to our speaker, Brian Smith. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. As stated, my name is Brian Smith. I work in the IBM DB2 Utilities Development Department. I am the technical lead for the team there. Part of the team is actually located in San Jose, California. Other parts of the team are located in Berlin, Germany. So today we're going to talk about version 8 utilities. I'd love to talk to you about version 9 as well, but we'll hold that for another teleconference. So let's move forward to slide 3 of the agenda. We'll focus on what changes were made in version 8, some of the highlights there, not all the changes, but some of the highlights. A quick slide on the unload products, and the majority of this presentation will be on the best practices. That's really the meat of the session here today. We'll go through a quick scenario of those best practices to see how they're applied, and we'll finish it off by talking about ZIP processors and how the utilities exploit the ZIP processors. So let's move on to slide 5. We added two new utilities in version 8, backup system and restore system. This is a phased rollout of a new strategy of backup and recovery within DB2 for ZOS. So this first phase was really targeted towards packaged applications like SAP or SQL, for example, because the granularity that you have on this backup and restore is at the system level. And in these packaged applications, typically you don't understand all the sub-objects that make up that application. So if you needed to perform a point-in-time recovery or a recovery of the entire system, you do it at the system level, not the individual object level. What I'm not going to be sharing with you in detail today is that in version 9, you have the ability to do system-level backups and do recoveries at the object level using that system-level backup. That's not until version 9, and that's this phased approach that I was talking about. Second, you've got the ability to load and unload data with delimited support. This is great for taking data out of Oracle and putting it into DB2 for ZOS. The Oracle extract programs don't understand fixed offsets, but they do understand comma-separated values. So this is a great way to get data across different platforms. Third, we've made some changes. It's not a complete set, but we've made some changes to picking better defaults for optimum performance out of the box. Two of those are listed here. The first one is sort keys. So sort keys, we're going to talk about this more later in the presentation, but sort keys is what controls whether or not we're going to be building the indexes in parallel or not. That keyword on load, reorg, and rebuild is now the default within version 8 and going forward. So you no longer have to worry about specifying that value. If you didn't have it, and as you migrate to version 8, you'll suddenly see that we will start building those indexes in parallel, which is a great thing. It'll help reduce your elapsed time. So hopefully you'll see that right when you move to version 8 if you weren't already using it. Second keyword here is sort data. There's two ways that we can order the data within the table space when doing a reorg table space. One is to unload the data out of the table space by using the clustering index and then simply reloading that data in that clustered index order. The other way we can order that data is to unload all of it and then feed that table space information through a sort and then reload it. Well, in almost all cases, that latter scenario is the better, higher performing one, which kind of gives you an indication of how expensive indexes really are, that they are expensive. And so by feeding this through a sort first and then reloading it back in almost all cases, you'll burn less CPU and you'll have better elapsed time. I mentioned an APAR on this slide, PK18059. We added after GA of version 8 because we found some folks really couldn't handle this case of always using sort data, of always pushing all the data through a sort. And the scenario there where folks needed to turn off sort data and say sort data no, is in a case where they simply don't have enough sort disk space to support that large sort. because some folks have some really large partition table spaces, and they simply don't have enough sort space to unload and sort all of that on disk. So for them, they have to go through that clustering to index, and that's why we provided this keyword of sort data know. By the way, that sort data know is also supported in version 7. It's ignored, but it's accepted, so you don't have to worry about making this syntax change right as you migrate to version 8 if you fall into that category. Lastly, we also provide the ability now to rebalance data across partitions. So let's say you're partitioning your data not for operational reasons, where maybe the first partition contains January and the second contains February, but instead you're partitioning just something that's big and you want to divide it, you know, across multiple data sets so you can run utilities, commands, have locking at this lower level of granularity. In those cases, you don't really care what the limit keys are for each partition. Well, that's the case for rebalance. You might develop some skews in your data over time, and you really want to rebalance the data across all those partitions. So you can now do that with the rear utility in version 8. Move to slide 6. Statistics. So we continually add more and more statistics in every release of DB2, it seems, at least for the last 3 releases, because the biggest reason why the optimizer does not pick the best access path is because it doesn't have enough information about the data that it's accessing. So that's why we're adding more statistics. In this case, these statistics have always been around, but we've never collected them with the RunStats utility. We call these non-uniform stats on non-indexed columns. So currently, RunStats will collect non-uniform stats on indexed columns, and if you were to collect these on non-indexed columns and provide them in the catalog, then the DB2 optimizer would use these during bind or prepare processing. In fact, there was a downloadable program called DStats that's still out there on the web to collect these today if you're running, say, on version 7. Well, now RunStats will collect this information for you. We also made a change to Visual Explain. And the reason I mention it here is that in rewriting Visual Explain for version 8, we added a new component called Stats Advisor. You know, there's a lot of different stats that you can collect now with RunStats. The syntax for RunStats has become almost as complex as the load utility. It's becoming quite complex. And what's difficult is for administrators to know which statistics they need to collect. Because if you collect all statistics, then you're burning a lot of CPU, and in many cases, it's not for any benefit because you don't need all column statistics, for example. You don't need non-uniform stats on all columns. You really only need them on the ones that are going to be interesting for the SQL that you run. So that's why we developed this Stats Advisor. Stats Advisor can take SQL statements, and it will use the optimizer, and it will spit out RunStats syntax for you. So it will tell you exactly what statistics are interesting given a set of SQL statements. This gets improved also in version 9, and our trend here is to really get you out of the mode of having to understand which stats to collect. So our first step is giving you the ability to understand what stats to collect based on SQL statements, and we're moving toward the path of, within the engine, understanding what statistics are needed and collecting those for you automatically so you don't have to run RunStats. There's other enhancements here as well in version 8 that apply to RunStats with the history. You can now do reorg shareable change with discard. So in version 7, you were not able to use the discard functionality with reorg shareable change. And reorg shareable reference can now be run on the catalog tables with links. By the way, if I skip some bullets here, it's not because I'm missing them. Well, I might be, actually. But it's usually because there are additional information that's of lower interest. In fact, I'll even be skipping past some slides entirely, but I'll let you know when I do that. We're on slide 7 now. So DF sort. So in version 8, we removed the need for an external sort product with the utilities. There are several reasons why we did this. The biggest reason is so that we could improve our serviceability of the product. For example, we don't have other sort programs like SyncSort back at the lab. And sometimes we found cases where defects where it only happened maybe with the SyncSort product. So we had to ship an APAR fix to customers to test it. And we really don't like doing that. So we actually took a note from one of our competitors here who embed a sort into their utilities. We said, well, heck, why don't we do that also? It just so happens that our sort within IBM, DFSort, is already out there. In fact, if you have ZOS installed, you've got DFSort as well. So we developed a new license interface so that you don't have to have a license to DFSort for the utilities to use them. One note of caution here. If you're not already a DFSort customer, though, then I want to point to some mandatory reading here, which is this informational APAR, II-14047. This informational APAR was developed soon after we went GA with version 8, and it talks about everything that you need to know about DFSort if you're only using it for the purpose of the DB2 version 8 utilities. So you don't have to become a DFSort expert. I have some more slides on this later on when we get to the best practices. But you don't have to be a DFSort expert. You just need to know a few things, and this informational APAR boils down those few things for you. Also provides some other links to other DFSort tuning if you feel that you're not getting the sort of performance that you want. Let's go on to slide 8. There are several post-GA APARs that were shipped. Here's a list of those. The ones that are in blue I'm going to cover in subsequent slides, so I'll just cover all the ones that are in black here. And the ones that are in blue, I do list all the APAR numbers, so you use this as reference to see if you have these applied or not. The first is check index shareable change. The problem with check index today in version 7 and prior to this APAR in version 8 is that you take a write outage during the time that we run the check index utility. So what this change does is we copy the table space data sets as well as the index data sets that you're checking against. We copy those data sets, and then we run the check utility against those copies. And if you have flash copy version 2, which provides data set level flash copy, then this copy function is very, very quick. You know, it's on the order of, you know, 1-2 seconds. We have to drain the writers off the objects first, take the copy, and then we run against that copy. So if you have flash copy version 2, then this copy process is very quick. But even if you don't have flash copy version 2, it's still beneficial to use this in terms of availability because your write outage time is only the time required to copy the data sets, which is much less than the time required to run the check utility. The crossloader prior to this APAR was not able to support lobs that were bigger than 32K, so that's addressed here in this APAR. We'll skip down to the last bullet. Switch to UTRW during your util term. So if you're running rear shovel change, during the util term phase, we're doing various things like updating statistics, deleting shadow data sets if they're DB2 managed page sets. And that can take a while if you have a lot of partitions. Let's say you have 4,000 partitions. That can take a significant amount of time. And during that util term phase, prior to this APAR, we're in a UT-UT state, which means that no one has any access to those objects. There's really no need for that. It was overly restrictive, so we've changed that to put the objects into a UTRW state, which means they're available for read-write access while we do that stats and cleanup work. The last bullet talks about reducing switch phase time if you have copy no indexes. Again, this applies for reorg shovel change. Yeah, just as it says, we reduce the switch time phase. So let's look at some of these in more detail, like lob handling for load and unload. So on slide 9, so let's go forward to slide 12, lob handling for load and unload using file reference variables. The problem here is being able to overcome the MVS data set limits of the maximum LRUCL size. So the maximum LRUCL size on a physical sequential format data set is 32K. So in loading and unloading, you know, records that are within the 32K size, when you have lobs, large objects that could be much, much larger than that, you know, how do we handle these? Well, our solution here is to reference these by what we call file reference variables. You're going to see these later in version 9, where in any SQL statement where you can place a literal, you can also use a file reference variable. So you can say select from where column is equal to, and you give a file reference variable. That's the same design here that we use for load and unload. If you go to slide 13, here's an example with loading. So let's say that in the middle of the screen there, I have my input data set. In green, I have my employee numbers. Red is my resumes, and blue are my photos. So the resumes and photos are lobs. They are large objects. And I have some new syntax now in my load utility, namely clob f, f for file, blob f, again, f for file. And that's indicating the load utility that the actual lob isn't located in the input. Instead, what's located in the input is a file reference variable. So go to this member of a PDS or PDSE, or go to this file name in an HFS or ZFS file system to pick up the contents of this lob and stick it into the table space. Conversely, on the unload utility on slide 14, is changed to allow you to unload and place a file reference variable in the output data set for the unload. There's a little bit additional work here that's required within the utility, in that you need to tell us, you need to tell the utility where to place these lobs. So we do that through templates. So my first template here, lob FRV1, shows the template name for my resume. And you can use all the substitution values that we provide in template support. So it's un.database.tablespace.resume. And that's going to be the PDS or PDSE name that we're going to use. And then the unload utility will generate a unique member name and then stick the lob into that member. So you can see there in the output, I've got my file reference variables. Notice that in that first output record, the member name is AI3WX3JT. That member name is going to be the same for all lobs that are part of that same row. So you notice that for the resume and for the photo, they have that same member name. If you're using applications to go access these things later, that's an important important fact to keep in mind. That's how we do load and unload of lobs. Slide 15 talks about another change that we made to reorg shovel change, and that is that if for some reason we get a resource unavailable from the reorg utility, before we would simply issue a resource unavailable message, and it was really up to you to determine, okay, well, why was it that the reorg wasn't able to break in? What we'll do now in the utility output is what's shown here in red. We'll actually do a display database claimers. We'll issue that command, and it will be in your job output. And you'll be able to see exactly who these culprits are that you need to go look at. You know, these could be, you know, long-running URs that aren't committing. They might even be long-running readers that are not committing. In fact, that's probably the biggest challenge that I see DBAs have today in getting the online reorgs to be successful is monitoring and policing the long-running reading applications because they're not committing. And so an application programmer, application developer, oftentimes they think, well, I don't need to commit. I'm just doing reads here. But they really do. The only way we can break in with a utility or a command and obtain a drain on an object is on a commit interval. So it's important that those read-only applications are committing. Next slide, slide 16, talks about an APAR that is just out, I think, now. I think it's just now available. And that's being able to load via a batch pipe. So ignore my picture there for a moment. Think about being able to load data, maybe from a program, that you write information into a batch pipe. You write it into a data set, but it's really a virtual data set. You write that into a pipe, and then you have the load utility read from this pipe, this batch pipe. So that's pretty powerful because if your application is generating data to be loaded, you don't need to write this out to a physical sequential data set and then read that in with a load utility. You can simply write it to a pipe. It will buffer it. Once that buffer is full, then the next write to that pipe will be halted. It'll be stopped until we can consume some of the records on the back end with the load utility. What's really powerful here, though, is what I show in the picture, where you can do this remotely. So consider a case where you have an application that's running on some remote system. It could be AIX or Linux, Windows, could even be System Z, ZOS. And that application can use an FTP operation now. So we made a change to ZOS FTP so that you can FTP directly into a batch pipe on ZOS. So you start that operation, you start feeding data in, and then you create another thread that will call the load utility, and you can do this remotely with the SIR procedure interface, which we'll talk about more later, to invoke the load utility via the disinutilS SIR procedure. This load utility will have a specification of the subpipe name. It's actually done on the template statement, and it will read from that batch pipe and then load directly into the DB2 for ZOS table. There's going to be an article on this, by the way, in the, I'd say here in the next IDEX Solutions Journal. I think it's due out pretty soon now. I don't have my hands on it yet, but when it does come out, you can read that or go to the IDUG website to look at the article. Let's go to slide 18, unload products. I mentioned here that we have two unload products. Notice that I'm not saying three unload products. I say that tongue-in-cheek here. I don't consider DSNT-IUL an unload product. It really is just a sample program that runs SQL and puts the information out into an output flat file. So what I am referring to unload products are the unload utility, which is part of the utility suite, and the DB2 high-performance unload utility, otherwise known as HPU. So, you know, you look at these names and you think, okay, well, I've got a high-performance unload, and then I've got the other one. Well, that must be the low-performance unload. But that's actually not necessarily the case. In fact, in many cases, the unload utility has equal and sometimes even better elapsed time performance than the high-performance unload utility. If there is a difference between these two, it would be in terms of CPU time. The high-performance unload utility, in many cases, will consume significantly less CPU than the unload utility. So why did we name it, you know, HPU? Why did we name it the high-performance unload? Well, when we came out with that product, we didn't have plans yet to build an unload utility within the utility suite. So that's why we have this confusing naming scheme. Otherwise, we never would have called it the high-performance unload. We would have, I don't know what we would have called it, but it wouldn't have been high-performance unload. And know that it's okay, actually, to use both of these in concert. Many folks do. The unload utility is really geared more towards database administrators, and HPU is geared towards application developers. In fact, HPU's interface is an SQL interface. You can say select from where and give your criteria, and as long as HPU can satisfy that SQL statement by accessing the underlying vSAN dataset, then it will. If it's too complex, let's say, for example, you put in a subquery or you join two tables together. Well, we don't have a query compiler within the HPU product, so what HPU will do is take that and run it similar to how DSNT-IUL would run it. You'll just run that SQL statement, and as the data comes back from the SQL interface, you'll stick that information into the output file in the unload format that you specified. Okay, slide 19, and we'll get into best practices now. So slide 20. So for the backup recovery suite of utilities, copy, recover, quiet, these are some of the best practices. And these are really developed by talking with folks like yourselves of who are using the products, as well as our performance lab. But most of these don't come from, you know, directly from development. They come from experiences that are shared among users of utilities. So for the copy utility, first one here is the parallel keyword. So the parallel keyword kicks off multitasking for the backing up of a list of objects. Now, this only applies if you give it a list of objects, through like a list def, or you provide a list of table spaces or indexes on the copy utility statement itself. Check page default is check page no. Now, check page is doing some additional integrity checks of each page, looking at the page header, page tail, looking at the grid map, making sure every ID map is pointing to an actual row, making sure that every row is being pointed to by a grid map entry, some other checking as well. And this can add additional CPU time to the copy utility, maybe on the order of, say, around 5% more CPU. Now, we recommend that you do run with check page, and the simple criteria is to determine, do you want to know that you have a broken page at backup time or at recovery time? Most folks answer, well, at backup time is when I want to know. I want to know as soon as possible so I can fix the issue. You'll see in other presentations in version 9, we actually turn this on by default for you, and the overall CPU consumption is less for the copy utility. In fact, CPU consumption on all the utilities in version 9 is less. We had a large focus to reduce CPU consumption in the utilities in version 9, and that's delivered there. So check page is on by default in version 9 with an overall CPU reduction. Incremental copy. So about half of our customers use incremental image copy and half of them don't. Different reasons on why they do that. Many times it's shops may not even be able to tell you why they do that. They just say, well, we just always done it that way. When you do look at that subset of folks who are taking incremental image copies, not all of them use the same criteria for determining whether to take an incremental image copy or a full image copy. Most folks are using somewhere between like 5 to 10%. And they say, well, if more than 10% of the pages have changed, then take a full image copy. And if less than 10%, then take an incremental image copy. The recommendations that I give on this chart are much more exacting. And if you understand how your pages are updated, you can actually go anywhere between a range of, say, 5% up to 80%. And at 80% cases, if all the updates are all sequentially updated together, let's say you have a table space that's a journaling table space, and all the new entries get added at the end of the table, that would be a good case to actually bump up your threshold between incremental and full image copy up to as high as 80%. And lastly, for copy, consider copying indexes. This was added back in version 6, and not a lot of folks are using the copy index capability. I'm sure you've seen the performance information that shows a recovery of an index versus rebuilding an index. It's a night and day difference. I think most folks seem to be avoiding using copy index because they think that it might be an all or nothing type scenario, that if I start copying my indexes, I have to copy all of my indexes, and I simply don't have enough storage space to house all that. So maybe consider taking this in small chunks, maybe only your highest priority applications that you need to bring up the quickest, the fastest. Consider copying those indexes to speed up your recovery time. For the recovery utility, there's also a parallel keyword here as well. This is a no-brainer. In fact, I need to make this the default for the utility. We haven't done it yet. But the parallel keyword should just be the default. Just like the copy utility, it's going to use multitasking to restore multiple page sets back, and then we're going to then do the log apply processing. And we also now do log apply processing in parallel. Hopefully most folks have fast log apply enabled. Most folks I talk to do, by the way. And that's good because it's going to reduce the rereading of table space data as we're doing the log apply processing. That could speed up your recovery time by sometimes up to like 4x times faster. The last bullet under recover is how many jobs per member. You know, never more than 10 jobs, recovery jobs per member. The reason why we have this is that the largest fast log apply buffer you can put in DB, you can have in DB2 is 100 megabytes. Each recovery utility is going to use 10 megabytes. So the 11th job is not going to be able to use fast log apply. That's why we say never more than 10. However, the sweet spot in terms of the number of recovery jobs to run when you're doing a massive amount of data recovery is somewhere much less than 10. It's probably somewhere in the range of somewhere between 2 and 5. It's really complex to try to come up with a strict guideline on this because it depends on so many different things. It depends on your channel speeds, your CPU speeds, are your backups on tape versus disk, et cetera. So you have to determine the sweet spot really yourself, but just know that never submit more than 10 jobs at a time. And then within each of those jobs, somewhere around 20, 30, 40 objects per recovery statement is appropriate. Don't put 1,000 objects within a single recovery statement because you're going to lose the benefits of the fast log apply. I'm going to skip Quiet. I'm going to skip Large Buff, and those are just for you to read and reference. Slide 21 for load. So load log no. I always like telling this story about turning off logging. For years, many folks have told us in development, give me the ability to turn logging off, because they felt that if they could turn logging off, then they would get increased performance, because logging must have some amount of overhead. Well, it does have some amount of overhead, but it really doesn't result in increased performance for a given application, because the logging is actually quite efficient. It's all done asynchronously until you get to commit time, and if you're data sharing, we'll write that to the CF, which is very fast. And this really wasn't understood until we got to version 9 during the beta program. We had some customers come back and try this new function we have in version 9, which is the ability to alter logging on and off for a set of objects. So they went off and they altered logging off for a set of table spaces and indexes, and they ran their application, and they saw that it didn't speed it up at all. So we delivered this function in version 9 simply to reduce log volume. It's the same reason why you want to run your load utility with log no option, to reduce the log volume. You probably can restart your load utility, so there's really no reason to log all those data changes. It's not going to improve your performance. It's just going to reduce your log volume. And then if you're doing a load replace, then take an inline copy. We'll talk about inline copy in a few more bullets. Keep dictionary. Dictionaries have a pretty long shelf life. So rebuilding a dictionary each time you do a load, unless that data has changed so significantly in that it no longer contains maybe addresses or names of folks that live in one country but now in a different country that have very different spellings of names or addresses, if you don't have that kind of a drastic change, then you'll be fine keeping your old dictionaries. It also reduces the CPU time, both for load and for reorg. Load partition parallelism, this was introduced in version 7. This is a case where if you have a partition table space, let's say you have three partitions, and you want to load all three partitions in parallel. In prior to version 7, and even today, you could run three separate load jobs, one against each one of those partitions at the same time. And it's fast, but in version 7, we made a change so that you don't need three jobs. You can run it with one load job and provide three different inputs, and we will kick off the parallelism to load those parts in parallel. So on the surface, it sounds like this is a usability enhancement, and it is, but ever more importantly, it is a performance enhancement because we're able to perform the index maintenance much more efficiently, much more like a rebuild index versus individual key updates, which is what we had to do when you had three separate load jobs. So it's a big performance improvement here to take advantage of the parallelism built into the load utility. Inline copy and inline stats. Taking an image copy inline in load utility, highly recommended unless the data is not going to be changed, and after you do a load, you repair and turn off copy pending. If the data is going to be updated, though, we recommend you do an inline copy. It's practically free. And inline stats will save you the additional read of the data to collect those statistics. So if you're normally following your load utility with a RunStats utility, simply collect those stats inline, and you'll save quite a bit of I.O. Index parallelism, sort keys. We talked about sort keys earlier. If you're on version 7, you need to specify it. If you're on version 8, don't worry about it, unless you're loading from tape. So if you're loading from tape, sort keys not only indicates that we want to build the indexes in parallel, but it also is a way for you to provide to the utility information about how much data you're going to be loading into the table. So if the utility can't figure out how big that is, then we have to go through and we read all the data and we put off into another data set to figure out how big it is. But if you can provide the information here on sort keys, then we know up front how much data is going to be loaded, and we can avoid that intermediate write and the read. If the input is on disk, then don't provide it at all. Just leave it blank. We can look at disks. We can look at data sets on disk and figure out the size of those. If it's a member of a PDS or a tape, though, I can't tell how big that input file is. So please provide a value for sort keys in those two cases. We're going to skip the rest of the items on that slide and go to reorg. A lot of these are the same between load and reorg because load and reorg share quite a bit of the same code. So log no is the same, keep dictionary is the same. Sort data, again, if you're on version 7, we recommend that you use sort data in version 8. It's the default. No sysrec. This is a high-risk, high-reward type option. No sysrec says avoid intermediate I.O. between my unload and my reload steps. And however, so that saves I.O. However, if I were to fail during the reload phase, then the object is going to be placed into a recover pending state. So to counter that, you may want to take an image copy of an object of the table space first and then run reorg with no sysrec. But your reorg is going to fly when you don't have the no sysrec parameter specified. Inline copy, inline stats are the same, and sort keys is the same. Let's go to slide 23. I've been talking about sort keys quite a bit. Again, sort keys is what triggers our parallel index build. And the point I want to get across to you on this slide is that a higher degree of parallelism is better when we get to the parallel index build. And the reason why is because I have an example here where I have three indexes, an account index, a branch office index, and a customer name index. The first index is 5 bytes, second one's 3, and the third one is 40 bytes. So let's say that if I were to achieve a degree of 3 in my parallel index build for a load, reorg, or a rebuild job, that I need, say, 5 megabytes for that first index, 3 megabytes for the second index, and 40 megabytes for the third one. And that's great. That's the least amount of disk space that I would need to perform those sorts of those keys. If for some reason I had to reduce the degree of parallelism down to, say, a degree of 2, then I have to merge the two of these sorts together. In this case, I'll merge the account index and the branch office index down into one single sort, and I'm going to have to pad all of those 3-byte keys to be 5-byte keys. So instead of 5 megabytes plus 3 megabytes for disk space, I have to allocate 10 megabytes. So not 8, but 10. So instead of having 48 megabytes total of disk space allocated, I have to allocate 50 megabytes. Well, that might not seem so bad, but if I went down to a degree of 1 and I had to merge all these key sorts into one single sort, then I would need 120 megabytes of disk space versus only a 48 megabytes in the case of degree equals 3. So the message I want to leave you with here is, if you see that your degree of parallelism is reduced for any reason within your utility jobs, try to relieve that constraint. Usually it's virtual storage. Usually folks aren't giving enough virtual storage to the batch address space where the utility is running. So if you can increase that, you'll not only use less disk space here, you'll also see less CPU time because sorts are not linear. So having more parallel, smaller sorts will actually consume less CPU than one large sort, and your elapsed time will also be decreased because we're not doing as much I/O here. Okay, slide 24, reorg shell level change best practices. So reorg shell level change, sometimes called online reorg, these are our recommendations for those parameters. The most important one here is the drain all. The default is drain writers. And one would think that, and this comes into play when we do our last log apply iteration, one would think that only draining the writers, not the writers and the readers, would be a higher availability option. In fact, it sounds like it is. But in fact, when that's coded, many times the reorg is unable to actually to finish and break in because many applications, when they're going through an object and they're determining where they're going to do an update, they do a read first, followed by an update. There's no commit in between there. So if they have a read, if we did drain writers only, if an application comes in and does a read, and then the reorg then does a drain all, and it's waiting for that reader to get out, well, the application now is wanting to do a write. So they just hold each other up, and the reorg will then time out, and the application will continue, but the reorg was then able to continue. So drain all has a better chance of successful completion for the online reorg. So we recommend doing that. Slide 25. Only one I want to cover here is run stats on the bottom. So two things. One is run stats for shareable change. That's not the default. We'll change that in the next release. The other is, if you want to reduce the amount of CPU time that RunStats is consuming, you want to reduce the amount of CPU that is spent on column-level statistics. So column-level statistics are those things of high-to-key, low-to-key, and column cardinality. It's that column cardinality one. That's the one that's so expensive. If we're trying to determine the number of unique entries of a list of objects that are not sorted, then we have to go through this hashing routine, and it's quite expensive. So you can use sampling, and sampling only applies to the collection of column statistics. That's a good way to reduce it. The default for sample is 25%. We've seen folks go as low as 5% sampling and still and not have any significant access path changes. The other way you can reduce CPU consumption here is to not collect column statistics on those columns that are not accessed in your SQL. So, for example, if an address field is never used as a predicate within an SQL statement, then there's no value in collecting that information. This gets back to the Stats Advisor that we mentioned before. The Stats Advisor will help you understand which statistics you need to collect based on the SQL. So take that advice. The Stats Advisor will tell you exactly which column statistics that are interesting to the optimizer to use for the SQL statements. Okay, we're going to skip slide 26 and go to slide 27. I mentioned before we're going to talk a little bit more about DFSort. We recommend that you use dynamic allocation instead of hard coding in your sort work data sets. I mentioned that official APAR before, I-14047. We don't recommend you changing a lot of options within DFSort. There's a couple here. The one that's probably the most important is the second to the last bullet on this slide, the default number of sort data sets. So when you use dynamic allocation, you need to tell the utility how many sort data sets to allocate. And we pass that on actually to DFSort, and DFSort will allocate those data sets. The default for DFSort is 4 data sets. So if you're really large table spaces or really large indexes that they're doing sorting, that's not going to be enough. So what we recommend is to change the default number of sort data sets within DFSort, change that default to handle, say, 80%, maybe 90% of your jobs, so that you don't need to provide a sort num value on each of your utilities that are doing sorting. I also have some other good news here for you. In the near future, I'm speaking in terms of months here, not years, we'll be putting out an APAR that will eliminate the need to specify a sort num value in your utilities. We'll simply allocate enough disk space for you without you trying to figure out how many data sets it should be based on the size of the object. So that should be really good news. Stay tuned for that. Let's go to slide. I'm going to pass these next few slides. We're going to slide 30 for the scenario best practices. Actually, I really just provide this as a reference for you to look at. I give a very simple example here of reordering 2 table spaces, and then by way of illustration, the highlighted text in the comments, I'm showing how we're modifying the way we're invoking reorg so that we're using all those best practices that we just got done talking about. Slide 32, I mentioned before in the loading through a batch pipe how you can invoke a utility programmatically, not through JCL. And we do that with these stored procedures, DSNUTILS and DSNUTILE. DSNUTILU for Unicode. This is nice because slide 33 is an example using some Rex code. And by the way, if you want to have the entire Rex program, you can just send me an email and I'll send you the entire program of what we use in the lab. But this is an example of being able to invoke a utility then from a Rex program. The output, the sysprint from the utilities is written to a result set. Upon the conclusion of the stored procedure, we're going to return back a cursor that you would then select from to collect up all the messages that the utility issued. Because there is no JES involved here, right? We're not running batch. We're running this as a stored procedure. So it's important that if you do use DSNUTILS or DSNUTILU, that you retrieve those results back from the result set. So on slide 32, why would you want to do this? Why would you want to invoke through a stored procedure? Well, you might want to provide some additional logic that is either too difficult or maybe even impossible to code within JCL. Rich logic that will allow you to determine, time frames of when you want to run a utility or look at more complex conditions to figure out if you even want a utility to be run. So that's an example of why you might want to switch over to using the stored procedures. And if you don't want to do that, there's tools out there like the DB2 automation tool that do this the same kind of a thing. In fact, many of those tools use the stored procedure interface to invoke the utilities. Okay, we're on our final topic now on ZIP processors. Slide 35, move on to slide 36. So ZIP processors. ZIPs aren't really a new idea. We've had this idea of specialty engines ever since 1997 when we introduced the internal coupling facility. Later, we introduced the IFL for Linux. In 2004, we introduced ZAPs, which are for Java. We run the JVMs on the ZAP engines. And now we have the ZIP processors, which were really designed for DB2. And let me show you what we can run on those ZIP processors. So slide 37. I'll focus more on the utilities piece, but there's really other reasons why you might want to buy a ZIP in addition to utilities. These new engines are exclusively for the system Z9 mainframes. So if you don't have a Z9, then you can't run with a ZIP processor. The key with the ZIP processors is that they are significantly cheaper than the standard processors, and even more significantly is that they don't affect your IBM software license charges. So whereas a general-purpose CPU, when you add it, your IBM software bill will automatically go up because you've increased the capacity of that machine, when you add an engine that is configured as a ZIP processor, that does not increase your IBM software license bill. And I understand from other software vendors that they're following that same practice, although I don't want to represent them here. You can't have more ZIPs than you have standard processors. And workload manager, ZOS, is really the one who's managing this work between the general purpose CPUs and the ZIPs. It's determining if something is ZIP eligible to run on a ZIP, and if it can't run on that ZIP, let's say that the ZIP has a lot of other work that's queued up behind it, and other work is meeting its goals, then ZOS workload manager may dispatch that work over to a general purpose CPU. Again, as long as the other work is meeting its goals. I'm going to show you an example of that here in a minute. This is only available with DB2 version 8 with some PTFs. I recommend if you're interested in this, you go read this informational APAR, II14219. It talks about all the prereqs for DB2 and for ZOS, and mentions all the controls that you have in enabling the ZIP processor. So what can we actually offload with the ZIP processor? So I'm on slide 38 now. So the first one is the biggie. It really was designed for packaged applications or applications that are designed and are running on a system that is remote to the database server. So, you know, this is a configuration that really takes advantage of the mainframe as a data server, and you have DB2 on that, but your application is running somewhere else. It's running on Windows or Linux or maybe an AIX. So for those queries, those SQL statements that are coming into DB2, a portion, up to about 50% of that CPU time, can be directed to the ZIP processor, and the rest will be directed to the standard CPUs. So that's really, that's huge. That's a great way to reduce your cost and possibly deploy more applications onto more applications that have their data store on DB2Z than you might have otherwise. The second category is data warehousing applications. We're trying to get even more data warehousing workloads on the platform, and this is a way to attract that. So any queries that can take advantage of query parallelism and split up into multiple parallel threads, those parallel threads can all run at 100% on a ZIP processor. That's a way, again, a way to for us to attract, you know, these other workloads. The third way, then, that we can offload is with the utilities. And it's all of our index maintenance operations that are ZIP offloadable. So this affects load, reorg, rebuild index. Anything that we're manipulating the index, rebuilding it, that is ZIP offloadable. In the next slide, slide 39, I'm showing you an example of how you might see the ZIP time show up. This one happened to be for a utility, but it could also have been for an application. This is just simply an accounting report. I'm showing OmegaMon XE for DB2PE here, but this could be any tool that's looking at the IS-80 3 record. This is the accounting trace record. We added two new fields here. The first one, which is at the bottom of the chart, is the work that's offloaded to the ZIPs. It's shown as IIP CPU time. This is the amount of time that is actually offloaded to the ZIP processors. The number right above that is that which is ZIP eligible, but it ran on a standard CPU. So you'll see that there's a value there. There's 3.43 seconds, for example. Remember I said just a few slides ago that workload manager is the one who's deciding what work is going to run on a ZIP versus not run on a ZIP. Once work is ZIP eligible, it can run anywhere it wants to, and then it's up to workload manager to manage, you know, the overall environment. So if you set up your service classes with goals and all the work is meeting its goals, but you've got a queue, you've got work waiting to run on a ZIP, and you have standard CPUs that are ready for work, then it will move that work that is ZIP eligible and it will run on a general CPU. Additionally, you can even get this report and see what that ZIP eligible on CP value is going to be, even without a ZIP processor. So with version 8, and let me think, do you need to be on a Z9 or not? I don't know the answer to that question. Interesting. I think you have to be on a Z9, but I'm not positive. You can actually simulate this to see how much work would run on a ZIP processor. So the bottom number here, IIP CPU time, would show zero because you don't have a ZIP processor. But if you turn on a project CPU switch, then we'll show exactly how much time was eligible to run on a zip. And that could help you with capacity planning to figure out how many of these zips could you take advantage of. You can see that on the accounting trace record as well as the stats trace record. So you can look at an entire workload, not just one application at a time. Slide 40 gives some rough numbers of what you can expect to be offloaded by the utilities. So I'd rather you not look at these numbers and try to capacity plan. I'd rather use that simulation mode that I just described because, you know, the range is here. I've got 30 to 60%, for example, that could be offloaded for load or reorg. That's a pretty large range. So it's really best to use the projection capability to see exactly how many zips you would be able to exploit. I had an interesting story at a user group meeting in December. Someone asked me, I said, will this speed up my utilities? And I said, well, no, not really, because they're the same standard CPUs. Their clock speed and everything are the same as the normal CPU. So, no, you really won't see any better performance here. And I had a guy stand up and he said, all my utilities ran 5 times faster. So I said, wow, what do you mean? Why do they run 5 times faster? And what I didn't realize, but I did once he started speaking, was that when he's running his utilities, he had a lot of other workload in the system, a lot of other batch workload, non-utility workload taking place. And by putting these zip processors in there, his other workload wasn't using those zip processors. I think he added 2 zip processors and he had 5, I think, general purpose CPUs. So by adding those 2 zip processors, he just increased the capacity of his machine just for the utility operations, the index maintenance piece here. So they had full rein to those 2 CPUs for the index manipulation here, and he's able to run his utilities much faster. So I no longer say now that you won't see performance changes for your utilities here with zips. It's based on capacity. If you have other work that's not able to use those zips, but your utilities can, then yes, they will be able to benefit from them. Well, with that, I'm actually finished. Moved to slide 45, I guess, where I've got my email address there. If you have any other questions that we're not going to answer here, or if you're afraid to ask them now, please feel free to send me an email. I'll answer all of them. And with that, I'll turn it back over to the operator.
Brian, thank you very much. Before we take your questions, we'd like to conduct a brief electronic survey and get some feedback from you. Right after the survey, we'll have a live Q&A with the presenter. Now, again, your feedback is important to us. We appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key, followed by the number on your telephone keypad that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before you make your selection. First, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. Or if it was low, press star 3. And we'll pause for a moment to assemble your responses. Next, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference at the right level? If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. Or if it was more technical than you needed to hear, press star 3. Again, we'll pause. Question 3, are you currently running DB2 version 8? If you're running it in new function mode, press star 1. If you're running in compatibility mode, press star 2. Or if you have not migrated to DB2 version 8, press star 3. And we hope you've enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you're interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the product discussed today. If you would like follow-up or contact, press star 1. If not, press star 2. We'll assemble the responses to that final survey question, then we'll move on to your questions. Please stand by. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your patience and for your participation in our survey. We'll move on to your questions now. To ask your question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone at any time. At this time, I'll turn the call over to Brian while we wait for questions.
Thanks, Kevin. You know, by the way, during the presentation, I said I didn't know whether or not the ZIP simulation mode could be used on a processor that was older than the new Z9s. And I found out that it can be used. So even if you have a Z900, Z990 older model of the processor, you can still do that emulation to see how much offload you could get on a ZIP processor.
Brian, we have several questions in the queue at this time. We'll go to our first question. This is Gustavo Leonardo.
Great. Hi, Gustavo.
Gustavo, your line's open if you have a question. Well, hearing no response, we will move on to Stephen Diltz.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Hey, when's inline statistics going to get caught up with regular statistics?
Yeah, so I'm not sure if I mentioned it or not. The statistics that we'll collect inline, we can collect the table space level and the table level as well as index level stats all inline. The ones we can't collect inline yet are the column level statistics, those saved in syscolumns, syscallstats, syscalldist, and syscalldiststat. We're looking now within vNext, so vNext is the one beyond version 9, at addressing this. But actually, we're not going to address it in the way of collecting them in line. We're looking at ways to collect these asynchronously. So we really want to get out of the business of requiring you to worry about statistics. That's our end goal. And to look at workload coming in, look at the SQL that's being executed, and similar to the way that you might have seen in the stats advisor already, how we'll show what statistics the optimizer is interested in, we'll just start collecting those stats for you automatically under the covers. And yeah, that work will probably also run on a ZIP engine, by the way, since we're talking about ZIPs.
Great. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks.
And moving on to the next question, this is Mindy Curley.
Hi, Mindy.
Hi. My question is, are these new features available in all in compatibility mode?
Yeah, that's a good question. So our utilities haven't been playing the compatibility mode, or they haven't been playing the new function mode game like the rest of DB2. We're going to change that, by the way. but in version 8 and in version 9 as well, virtually all utility function is available in compatibility mode. So there are a few things. Now, when I think about version 8, the only thing that comes to mind is the system backup and system restore utilities. We do rely upon some function that's only present within the new function mode, but everything else I talked about today is available in compatibility mode.
Okay, thank you.
And just as a little commercial, when we move on to vNext, I plan on following the new function mode rules, because the reason why we want to is such that when you're in compatibility mode, we don't want you to make changes such that if you did have to fall back to previous release, that it would cause you some problems that, you know, if you use, say, new syntax that's only available in the new release, we don't want you to have to change that when you fall back. So that's the whole purpose of the new function mode. We're going to follow that in the future. But in version 8 and version 9, currently the utilities don't.
Next up, we have a question from Paul Nuss.
Hi, Paul.
Hello. I have a two-part question.
Okay.
One is, when using reorg to rebalance partitions, what is the cost or overhead in determining the new limit keys? And the second part of the question is about real-time statistics. And is DB2 going to start exploiting those as opposed to just writing them out for us to see?
Yeah, both are good questions. The second question is really good. First one, it's also a good question, but I'm not sure how to answer it. So overhead of reorg rebalance. The way that we determine the rebalance is during the unload phase of the reorg utility, we're counting up the number of actual records. We know exactly how many rows we have, how much data, how much space they take up. And then during the reload process, as we have loaded up, one over a number of partitions, amount of data, that's when we determine the new limit key, stick that in the catalog, and then move on to the next partition. I don't think you would see any appreciable overhead with this process versus you yourself going in and doing alter limit key values and then running the reorg utility. I don't think you'd see any difference. I don't think you'd be able to measure, I should say. I think it's very minor. Second question, real-time stats. In fact, we really should have a teleconference, I think, on real-time stats. I just finished putting together a presentation for a small seminar that we had last week in Italy, and it was on DB2 statistics. So it's a combined presentation of run stats and real-time stats. So in version 7, 8, and 9, the optimizer, as you correctly stated, the optimizer does not use the real-time stats for access path selection. In vNext, I think you're going to see some statistics, real-time stats, will be used. I understand, though, that real-time stats will never be able to collect all of the statistics. So, for example, column-level statistics, these ones that tell you, you know, the cardinality of a given column or column distribution information, those would be extremely difficult. I'd like to say impossible, but who knows? It doesn't feel like it would ever be possible for a real-time stats to maintain those types of statistics online. So there's always going to be a need for sort of an asynchronous stats collection for those types of statistics. However, all the other ones, the table space and index level statistics, things like end pages, inactive, those are all there, and we're ready to hop on those with the optimizer. Some of the, now you don't know the issues, but we have issues in using them. That's why they're not enabled yet in version 9. We're still working through some of those details. I think in vNext, the release after version 9, you'll see a lot more use of the real-time stats.
Great, thank you.
And you'll see it, by the way, not only just for the optimizer, but also for the utilities themselves. So today, when we're trying to calculate output file size or sort file size, the utilities today are looking at the run stats information in the catalog, not the real-time stats. And there's really no reason for that. So we want to also use real-time stats for the utilities calculation as well. Thanks for the question.
Moving on now to Deborah Jordan.
Hi, Deborah.
Yes, I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
The first, you mentioned that reorg rebalance is used with share level, none, and share level reference.
Correct.
Are we assuming you cannot use it with share level change?
That's a correct assumption. By the way, I don't think I'm going to ever add it for share level change.
I was talking to my team here, and we thought logically that makes sense.
You think logically it makes sense that?
That you do not have it with share level change.
Why?
Because if the data is being changed along with your changing your high key and low key, your high key values,
yeah,
wouldn't that make it take longer or kind of maybe mess things up a little bit?
Bless your heart. You're worried about us. I appreciate that. Actually, we know how to do it. It isn't we don't know of a technical obstacle that we couldn't overcome there. The reason why I don't want to provide it, though, is entirely different. In version 9, we have a new type of table spaces. They're called universal table spaces, UTSs.
Mm-hmm.
There's two types. There's partition by range, which is very similar to the classic partition table space that you know today.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have partition by growth. So partition by growth simply is very much like a linear or a non-partition table space today. As you add more data to it, we simply create another data set. But instead of that being, sometimes we call it a piece, it's a full-fledged partition. And we'll just keep adding partitions. So you can have this partition by growth table space where you don't want to give any hard limits for those partition ranges because it's just a big table space and you don't want to have to specify what those values are. You just want the thing to grow and get big.
Okay.
And so the reason why I don't want to provide rework rebalance shareable change is because I'd rather you move to the partition by growth table spaces and not have to worry about rebalancing. We'll automatically rebalance those for you with these partition by growth table spaces. And, I'd rather you move these new table space types in version 9.
Okay.
Yeah, but again, bless your heart for thinking that, you know, it might be hard for us. So that's very nice of you.
Well, I appreciate it. The second question is this. We really like the feature of displaying your claimers if there's an abandon in your reorg. Is there any plans in the future to do a display claimer in any of the other utilities?
Yeah, we want to add that to load as well, and we're looking at doing that through an APAR as well. We don't have an APAR opened yet for that.
Is that going to be an APAR that we'll be able to put on with version 7 and 8 or just with version 8? Or?
Yeah, 8 is what I'm looking
at. With 8?
Yeah. I'm really discouraged, and I'm also trying not to add much more to 7.
Oh, I agree, yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully for obvious reasons, we really want you to move to 8. So I want to make it even more attractive for you. So, yeah, look for that in APAR in version 8 that will do that display claimer so you can see those culprits holding up your loads as well.
Oh, great.
Okay, good.
Very good.
Thanks for the questions.
Next up, Brian, we have Julie Holman.
Hi, Julie.
Hi. Well, that was my question on the claimers.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
All right. We will move on then to Mark Kim.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, I had a question. When you had mentioned trying to use dynamic allocation in DFSort for, say, a rebuild index, is there any guideline as to, like, what increment you should bump up sort num? Because I had a situation where I had to bump it up to, like, 110 before that rebuild completed successfully.
Wow, that's a really big index then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well I should say it's a really big index, or you've got a sort pool that's highly fragmented. So, you know, this whole specifying the sort num is it's almost voodoo science here because even though you can calculate exactly how much sort space would be needed for a given utility, and we give those formulas in the books for rebuild or for load or for reorg, when we go out and we allocate these data sets, we don't know if we can get the size of data sets that we want. So even though we give you the ability to specify how many data sets to allocate, we may not be able to allocate the size that we want, so we have to settle for a smaller size data set. And anyway, it's a real hassle. And this is the reason why we're working on this APAR that will go back to version 8 that will eliminate the need for you to specify sort num. So
right.
You really want that, but that's coming out, you know, that's a third quarter thought. That's probably a August-September thought for this year on version 8 and version 9. So in the meantime, you need to specify this sort num value. And you don't want to go too high because if you just specified, you know, 255 for all of your utilities, then we're going to always allocate that many data sets for the sorting. And as I mentioned briefly in the presentation today, the more data sets that you allocate, the more space that we're using below the line, the 16 megabyte line, and that is going to limit the number of parallel index build tasks that I can start. So you got to find kind of a sweet spot in there. And in your case, you had to slowly increase it until you actually get enough sort data sets to be allocated, disk space to be allocated, but you didn't want to max it out because you'd probably end up with no parallels, and that would be equally as bad. I don't have an answer for you on how to set that. which is why we're working on this APAR in version 8. It really depends on how fragmented your sort pool is. If it's not fragmented and we're able to get all the data sets of the size that we want, then it's a simple calculation of figuring out how much disk space you need, and then depending on the devices that you have, let's say you had mod 3s, those are about 3 megabytes in size each, so we could allocate data sets of about 3 megabytes each. You could figure out then how many data sets need to be allocated. But you're really waiting for the SAPAR, unfortunately.
Okay, and one follow-on. When you said that if you're virtually storage constrained and you get that message in the utilities,
yeah.
Is there a way to change that in the utility via a control card?
Yeah, you want to give more virtual storage space to the utility in the batch job itself. So you can control that with a region parameter. Now a lot of folks have come back and they said, well, I modified that. You know, I'm at region equals zero meg, which means unlimited. But they still saw that they were constrained. And what's usually the cause of that then is that there's an installation-wide cap on how much virtual storage will be given to a batch address space. So there's parameters set in a member called IEFUSI. It's a PARMLED member. You have to go to your sysprogs and ask them what that's set to. They might have capped all of your jobs to something, you know, as low as, you know, say 5 megabytes. And so, you know, you're asking for a lot more, but it's being capped there in that IEFUSI exit.
Oh, okay. All right.
I've heard that there's also a way to cap the amount for each given batch address space by way of JES as well, but I don't know the parameter for that one.
Okay.
So you might need to talk to your system programmer guys and see what they're capping you at.
That was very helpful.
Okay, thanks.
Moving on now to Sanjay Rao.
Hi, Sanjay.
Hi, Steve. This was with reference to reorg discard with share level change. I remember we had a situation where we wanted to do a discard share level change, but we had run into a problem that the data in the table space could not change while the operation was being performed. Has that changed?
So the way that the discard processing works is it's a phase after the unload phase that we go through. I can't think of a reason why we would hold up any updating SQL statements unless you got to the switch phase. I don't know the reason why that would have been taking place. Is there a PMR for this one already open?
We just tried it. We were basically trying to find the fastest way to empty out data from a table in a segmented table space where there's only one table per table space. And
the fastest way to do that is to load your place with a DD dummy.
Yeah, but we did not want to take an outage.
You're emptying the table space. What do you mean, no outage?
They're going to be readers constantly.
Oh, I see.
Now trying to go 24/7, basically. And the other question I had was, actually, this was also a part of the DB2 utilities guide. I think it was marked like if you're using discard, you cannot have any updates to the table, and if so, your reorg will terminate. And the documentation was accurate. I was wondering if that has changed. And the second question I have for you quickly is we have tried to empty tables out using a mass delete instead of using load replace or reorg share level change discard. Is that acceptable, and how large can the tables be for us? If it is acceptable to perform a mass delete, how large can these tables be?
Okay, so if it's a segmented table space and you're going to do a mass delete, which means you're doing just a delete from table.
That's correct.
And you're asking how long that would take?
No, it's fairly quick,
right.
Believe me. I mean, we have deleted close to 10, 15 million row tables in less than 2 seconds.
Right.
And then the question is just to make sure, and I'm sure, I don't know if other people have this situation, but everybody's trying to go 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and given the fact that we cannot use load replace or reorg share level change discard, which is the closest to what we had gotten, can we use mass delete?
Yeah, you certainly could. So the reason why mass delete is so fast is because of the segments. We're not actually going off and, and updating all those pages. We're simply marking the SpaceNet pages as showing that those pages are empty. So it's the reason why it is so fast. We're just going to each of the SpaceNet pages that are covering those segments for that table and marking them free immediately. That's a much better solution, I think, for you when when you have other readers that are also in there. However, that delete statement will get a new type of a lock called a mass delete lock, and a mass delete lock is not compatible with any readers or writers that are going to be on that same object. So I'm not really sure how you're going to be able to delete these things off and not interrupt your readers. I think you need to somehow quiet your readers to do this operation, and then your load replace with a DD dummy is going to be the most efficient, even over a mass delete, because mass delete is going to this isn't a big difference. Mass delete is going to log those changes made to the SpaceNet pages. That's not a big deal. There's not going to be a lot of logging there, so it's not a lot of log records. But it would be more efficient to simply scratch it out with a load replace with a DD dummy. I think you need to find a way to quiet your readers, though, unfortunately.
Sure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, Andre.
The next question comes from Fabio Sanchez.
I missed the name, but Mr. Sanchez?
Yes, sir. Is the inline copy usable for recovery purposes?
Yeah, absolutely. So inline copies are even better than most of your other image copies, because inline copies are always consistent, meaning that an inline copy can always be laid down and does not require any log to make it consistent. So they're always, some folks refer to these as being a share-level reference type image copy. So inline copies are a share-level reference image copy. But yeah, absolutely. If they weren't usable by recover, then you'd be wasting your time creating them. So yes, absolutely, they're usable.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Brian, next up is Pat Whalen.
Hi, Pat.
Hi. I just have a couple of quick questions. First, it's not really the utilities, but the ability to cancel a thread across members of a data group, is that something IBM's thinking about?
So a group-wide scope of cancel thread?
Well, it's just I'm on one member and doing a display use, I see that the contending thread I have to cancel is on a different member. As it stands now, I can't cancel that without reconnecting over to the new thread, over to the new member.
Yeah, I haven't heard that popping up on our list for. I don't believe it's in version 9. I haven't seen it on our version next or version 10. So, haven't heard about that one yet. If you haven't submitted a requirement, then I'd recommend that you do that through your IBM representative, and that way we get to capture this as a formal, trackable requirement that you can then ask questions on. You can say, what's the status of this? You can find out, and you'll also then be notified automatically when we do implement it.
Okay, and I'll do that. And I guess related to that is the ability of a utility to win. In other words, automatically clear. In other words, we have a certain window for our reorg, for instance. If someone's in there, is there any thought that we would have options for the utility that it would wait a certain time, but after that amount of time, it would cancel whatever it's contending with. Is that something?
Is that
something we're thinking about?
Yeah. So we have something like that. So it's not part of the utilities. There's actually a separate IBM product called the IBM DB2 Thread Expert for ZOS. It is a product that handles that exact situation. It will intercept your utilities, and if you specify that when I do a reorg on this object during this time of the day, if there are threads with this connection ID or this program name or this auth ID or whatever, you can selectively cancel those threads before that reorg runs in order to make sure that reorg or batch job or anything else that you've got running will be successful. So I'd recommend that you take a look at that. If you go to the IBM website and you type in DB2 Thread Expert, hopefully, I'm sure, I'm pretty confident that you'll see that pop up.
Okay.
That's what we have to address that. And by the way, there's other products with their companies as well that do this, not just IBM.
Okay. And last question, when is segmented partition table spaces going to be implemented?
Version 9.
Version 9? Good.
Yeah. So the universal table spaces that I was talking about earlier, this partition by range universal tablespace type is a segmented partitioned table. You can have a single table in there only, but it uses segments within that tablespace, and it is partitioned. So, yep, move to version 9 as soon as you can.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And, Brian, we have one more question remaining. This is Stephen Olszewski.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I have a question on the claimers with REGARD.
Okay.
We just put version 8 in over the weekend, and I was disappointed to see that I didn't get that display.
Oh, no.
Is there an APAR for it, or perhaps, or compatibility? Well, maybe that's the problem.
Nope. Wait a minute. You gave me the compatibility mode question again. Let me think about that. No. It's available in compatibility mode as well. In the charts, let me find the slide here.
15.
Yeah, I want to take you to slide 8. Slide 8 is the one that talks about just a single bullet for each of those enhancements I talked about, along with the APAR numbers. So that's what your APAR number is. It's there, PK00213.
Okay, so we have to apply that, and then we'll be in business.
Yeah, it sounds like you didn't pick it up, which is interesting, because that one's been out for... Well, you might not have picked it up. You probably went to the latest put level. We're probably really close to that latest put level. So.
Okay, thank you, Brian.
You're welcome.
And, Brian, we do have one more question that's just come in. This is from Rafael Cortez.
Hi, Rafael.
Hi, Brian. I'm glad to see that you're putting new defaults right out of the box, and utilities are going to work better.
Okay.
I have a question about recover. You said 20 to 30 objects per recover would be the best practice. Not sure what the reason for that again is.
Has to do with this fast log apply. So fast log apply is this feature that when we're running the recover utility or when you're doing DB2 restart or a start database command, that when we're going to be applying log records, we read in a buffer's worth of log records, and the recover utility will use 10 megabytes worth of space. So we read in all those log records that we need to apply, and we sort them by dbid.pfid. So we're sorting them in order of the actual table spaces that we need to apply these, and also by page number. So what this and once they're sorted, then we go through and we start applying the log records. The value that you get here is that you're going to minimize the rereads of the table space pages that we have log records for that same page. So let's say you have several hot pages, but those log records are spread out sufficiently such that we're going to have to reread in that same page to apply that log record. By doing this sorting process, we're able to apply those log records without having to reread those pages. So that's what fast log apply is. And the reason for 20 to 30 is because if you put 1,000 objects in a single recovery job, that single recovery job is still going to use 10 megabytes of space to read in those log records, and you are naturally reducing your hit ratio potential of those pages to already be in the buffer pool. So that's why we say, say 20 to 30. You can go to 50. You'll probably be fine, but you don't want 1,000. I guess is my point here. It's hard to give an exact number, but the 20 to 30 just seems like a good number that will help you take advantage of fast log apply.
Thank you. I guess my follow-up question is if there is anything that would keep you from providing us with a parameter so that we can still issue a recover for, several objects, use list def or whatever, but still limit the number of objects that will be recovered at a time so that we don't have to break up the recover.
Yeah, that's a good question. We talked about that, and instead we've decided to provide that functionality outside of our utilities in a separate product. So the DB2 Recovery Expert product provides that functionality that you're talking about. If you do a massive recovery, it will break those up into smaller chunks to maximize the throughput time.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And, Brian, there is one more question if you've got time to address that.
Okay, I've got to take off here in about another minute, but go ahead.
Okay, then we'll make this the last question, and it comes from Sivakumaran Jayalakshmi Parasami.
Okay, welcome.
Hi, Ben. You can call me Shiva. Okay.
Sure.
I just want to know what's the difference, in a recovery tablespace by using a shell level change copy and shell level none. I mean, the difference is related to copying the log records.
Are you asking what the difference is between a shell level reference and a shell level change image copy?
Yep.
Yeah. So a shareable change image copy is what we call fuzzy, which means that image copy by itself contains inconsistent data, and you can't use that image copy by itself with nothing else to do a restore type operation or to do an unload, let's say, against that image copy. That image copy can be made whole by use of the log. So in terms of if you're just using the DB2 copy and recovery utilities only, it doesn't matter at all. We will use the log to fix up that image copy and recover to the point in time or to currency that you specify. So most folks are doing share-level change image copies, which makes sense, right? You need to have your data online for your applications while you're taking your image copies. Some folks are using share-level reference because they want to be able to take that image copy by itself, maybe ship it to a remote site without the logs, and they want to be able to lay it down, and they want it to be whole and consistent. Or maybe they want to run an unload utility against it, and they need to have the results from the unload to be consistent. Those are cases of why you might want to run share-level reference. But most folks are running share-level change these days.
Okay. And I do have one more question with the SOCNAM for the reorg, online reorg.
Yes.
Okay. The file size that it, you know, internally, I'm not going to give the file size when I use SOCNAM. So is it going to take it from the catalog that, what you're suggesting, like we need to do a run stats before we start using run SOCNAM?
Yes. So for a reorg, it's not important that you run a run stats first and for us to determine the sort data set sizes. We know what that's going to be. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. I said that wrong. Yes, it is still important that you run stats before you run the reorg to get an accurate
file estimate, file size. Yes,
a close to accurate value for file size that we'll pass to the source. Yes. Now, understand that value doesn't have to be exact. So, you know, only if your table has, you know, doubled in size is going to be really important that you run stats first. If the object has changed, you know, only say 10%, 20% in size, then it's not going to be that important, and you don't have to run stats before you run the reorg. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that's my question. But what if I dynamically overwrite by setting some DF sort palms, expressing the file size estimate by giving the row counts, row counts, that's
right.
Going to involve.
Yep.
And still we use that, sometimes we go out of, it says sort capacity exceeded. We'll go with certain 255, that's the maximum it's going to get allowed, right?
That's correct.
So sometimes we go with sort capacity exceeded.
Yeah, which simply means that you need to provide more sort disk space then. We're not able to allocate enough sort disk space. Remember, sort data sets can't span volumes. That's true for any sort of product, by the way.
Yeah, we work with storage team to make it to no multi. So, yes, and we use mod 3 over here.
Okay, so you, what you could do is move to ZOS 1.7 and use mod 9s, mod 24, mod 27s, or mod 54s,
yeah, mod
even 9. Even bigger volumes, and that will reduce the requirement for so many data sets.
Okay.
Thanks for the question.
Brian, there are no more questions. I'll turn things back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
I really appreciate all these questions. This is great. Thanks for attending today. And if any other questions that you have that you were shy to ask, please feel free to send me an email, and I'll get to those as soon as I can. So thank you very much.